And welcome to this week's edition of Buy the Book, brought to you by our friends at Koren Publishers. My name is Nachum Siegel. This is the Nachum Siegel Network, and I thank you for listening in at jmnam.org and nachumsiegel.com. Tuesdays at 10 a.m. in its original form, we speak with an interesting author about an interesting book, and today is no exception whatsoever. We have in front of us the brand new book entitled By Faith Alone, The Story of Rabbi Yehuda Amital. It is written by Elyashiv Reichner, translated by Rabbi Eli Fisher, and that is who joins us today here at this segment on the Nachum Siegel Network. First, let me tell you about the book, and then we will introduce the translator slash author, and we'll explain how all that works coming up here on By the Book. By Faith Alone chronicles the inspiring life story of Israeli religious and political leader Rabbi Yehuda Amital, who lived from 1924 till 2010. Rabbi Amital was one of Israel's most influential rabbis and teachers, and a builder of seminal institutions, including the Joint Army Yeshiva Hesder Program, the Har Etzion Yeshiva, and the Meimad political movement. He was a fascinating figure, a charismatic leader who refused to be viewed as a Hasidic Rebbe, a religious Zionist who supported territorial compromise for the sake of peace, and intellectual who loved the people of Israel. By Faith Alone is a moving biography of a visionary and realist who influenced a generation of religious Zionists, written by Elyashiv Reichner, an Israeli author and journalist, translated by renowned translator Rabbi Eli Fisher. Rabbi Fisher is a writer and translator from Baltimore and living in Modi'in with his wife and four children. His articles have appeared in Commentary, the Jewish Review of Books, the New York Jewish Week, Jewish Ideas Daily, Jewish Action, Jerusalem Post, the Intermountain Jewish News, and elsewhere. He has rabbinical ordination from the Israeli Chief Rabbinate. His current projects include editing Rav Eliezer Melamed's Panine Halacha series in English and preparing to serve as scholar-in-residence over Pesach on a Danube River cruise. Rabbi Eli Fisher, welcome to the Nachum Siegel Network.
How are you?
Baruch Hashem, nice to speak with you, and thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. First of all, regards from your brother Yigal from last night at a function.
That's great. Did he mention to you our connection to Rav Amital?
He did not.
Ironically enough, the apartment that we would stay in Yerushalayim on occasion was on Rehov Shachal, which I'm sure at this point you know very well.
Sure, in Givat Mordechai.
Yeah, it was just the apartment was about one floor below Rav Amital's apartment, and that was the context that we got to know him over the years. By Faith Alone, the story of Rabbi Yehuda Amital. So I assume this started as a Hebrew book. Could you give us the history of this publication?
Yeah, it was published initially on the occasion of Rav Amital's 80th birthday, and it was republished and re-released and translated into English after his passing in, it'll be 3 years this summer.
What was the name of the book? What is the name of the book in Hebrew?
In Hebrew, it's called Be'emunato.
And we call it in English, By Faith Alone. We got to get into this whole this whole translating thing in general. Fascinates me, and this book.
Well, let's start with how we translated the title.
Okay, go right ahead.
The word Be'emunato obviously comes from the pasuk in Habakkuk, I think it is. V'tzadik Be'emunato yichyeh. Right, that the righteous man lives by faith. And the title, By Faith, we felt wouldn't have had the same ring. And there's a rather well-known Gemara that discusses, that there were, how many principles the Torah is based on. That Micha came along and established two principles on which the Torah is based. Asot mishpat va'avat chesed va'atznei alechad im elokecha. Right, the three principles of doing justice and loving kindness and walking humbly with God. And then it goes on a list of how many, what were the basic principles of Yishayahu, and then it says that Habakkuk came and established one single principle, and that was the principle of faith, the principle of emunah, taking as a cue the pasuk, b'tzadik be'emunato yechyeh, So that pasuk was that verse was the inspiration for the book title. And so when we were thinking about how to, you know, what to call it, what to call the book in English, we used by faith alone. That doesn't mean that Rav Amital is, you know, his sole attribute was that of faith, but that he was a very, in a lot of ways, he was a very lonely figure. So that by faith alone, you might want to read it with a comma in there, meaning by faith and alone, that, you know, he's motivated by his faith to kind of go on his own direction and walk his own path.
Right.
As one of the editors put it, he said, "Lonely Man of Faith" would have been a great title, but it was already taken.
Very good. I sort of interpreted it a little differently after going through a whole, a significant part of the book. There was a loneliness to his own existence, meaning, and you emphasize this in terms of him being an Israeli religious leader and public figure. I'm reading from the wrong, a charismatic leader who refused to be viewed as a Hasidic Rebbe, a religious Zionist who supported territorial compromise. He had these different extremes, one might think, if we can call it that, in his persona and in his thinking. And that sometimes, I think, causes loneliness. You're gonna, when you seem to be alienating, I know that's a very strong word, I don't mean it like that, but I think you know where I'm coming from. When you seem to be alienating people on different sides, loneliness is often the result.
Yeah, I'll agree with that assessment. He had an iconoclastic streak, and that, you know, that sometimes, you know, makes it hard to, you know, makes it hard to have friends.
Right, and the faith aspect, I think, it goes a little bit further. Maybe I'm reading too much into this. But it's not just faith in the one above. I think he had a tremendous amount of faith in his own instincts and in making decisions to guide himself and others in different arenas in life. Would you say that he had an angle where he seemed to be to go with his instinct? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's something. It's something that I think dovetails with one facet of his personality, which is somewhat it's underexplored, let's say, and it's something that I would like to explore in whether with regard to Rav Amital or others, the notion that. I would say that Hungarian Jewry, or not all of Hungarian Jewry, but that there's at the very least a very strong impulse, a very strong sense within Hungarian Judaism that whereas opposed to, let's say, Lithuanian Judaism, there was this clear dichotomy between the way that you think, you know, the way that one thinks if one is a lamdin, and the way that one thinks if one is just a regular old balabas.
Right.
In Hungary, there was no such dichotomy the yardstick of common sense, the yardstick of what actually does make sense, was much more developed. You didn't have the same kind of caste hierarchy, in Hungary, you know, between, you know, the layman and the professional, you know, the professional Talmud scholar,
right,
that you had in other parts of the Jewish world. And I think you definitely see the heritage of that, the legacy of that, if you go to a lone shvut, where, you know, people don't posit that sort of break, that sort of gap between the Torah scholar and the balabas, that you can be a Torah scholar and be a regular Joe, and you can also be a regular Joe and also be a Talmud Chacham.
Right.
That it's something that I think we're lacking, and I think that's part of where Rav Amital was coming from. And you see it with other Hungarian Gedolim as well. It's not just Rav Amital. And it's something that I actually that I'd like to explore further if I ever get the opportunity.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about how to formulate, what I want to say next.
Oh, okay. Rabbi Elie Fisher is with us. The book is By Faith Alone, the story of Rabbi Yehuda Amital. If I could just add the following. Because of what you just described and how, his background and how that led to his way of thinking, his way of leading, etc., it sort of seems like what you just said in terms of what he was trying to create, the type of, yeshiva boy and then balabas that he was trying to create in the yeshiva, may have been even more of a focus of his than the fact that the yeshiva had to include army service. In other words, we know that there are some amazing Hesder yeshivas in Israel, and some of which are really known for that aspect of their yeshiva existence, that they are a yeshiva that combines a Torah study with army service. In this case, in Har Etzion, and you can tell me if I'm totally off on this, it seems like as important as that is, it may still take a secondary role in his view to what you just described.
So I don't know if he set out to say, okay, we want to create, an Israeli learned balabas. I don't think that that's what I think that in his worldview, there is no dichotomy between the Talmud Chacham and the balabas. That there's no excuse for a Talmud Chacham, for a balabas not to be a Talmud Chacham, and there's no excuse for a Talmud Chacham not to be a balabas. Meaning that even a Talmud Chacham, has to behave in a certain way, shouldn't condescend, shouldn't have certain expectations of how other people should treat him, should treat himself and not demand that, should treat himself as a regular person and not demand that others treat him differently. And at the same time, the notion that a balabas is somehow absolved from being a Talmud Chacham, that, and I'm not just talking about a balabas that, is Koveya Itim LaTorah and learns, for hours every day.
Right.
I'm talking about, a bona fide Talmud Chacham, that there's no excuse, for somebody that sits and learns and then goes on to do something other than, be a professional teacher or, a professional purveyor of Torah, should still be a Talmud Chacham. I think he might object to that characterization that he was trying to create a yeshiva for Balabatim, and that he didn't think that there was a yeshiva is for Balabatim, a yeshiva is for Rabbeim and Rashi Yeshiva, because those are the same people, right? There's no division. You're not talking about two different classes of people when you talk about Balabatim and Talmidei Chachamim.
Right. So the only way to reconcile my question would be then to examine whether any of the Hesder Yeshivot were founded specifically for the reason of combining the two, and everything else was secondary. That would be, I guess, a different analysis. I recommend to all of our listeners that to read his background, where he came from and what he went through and getting to the Holy Land, and then deciding to be a partner in founding this yeshiva in Gush Etzion. I recommend to everybody they read it. It's an amazing history and such an important one. How much does geography have to do with how the yeshiva ends up in terms of, because it's in such a sensitive location in the state of Israel, and obviously during its founding even more sensitive, and coming off of the amazing victory in the Six-Day War, and again, people should become more familiar with the tale. How much does geography, in your opinion, have to do with the success and with the direction of the yeshiva?
That's an interesting question. I don't know how much it has to do with it. I think that the yeshiva, that Rav Amital's yeshiva, has more to do with the people that have the people that it attracted, and that begins with Rav Amital, than it does with the particular location. It's located in the Gush Etzion, as is well known, that's an area of that's an area that was reconquered in 1967. Right. But the Gush Etzion has in the Israeli mind, Gush Etzion has a little bit of it occupies a little bit of a different space. That even before the general the enterprise of settling Yehuda v'Shomron, of settling the West Bank, what's today called the West Bank, got underway, there were already the government was already setting up communities in Gush Etzion, because Gush Etzion was one of the last outposts. The Gush Etzion was the site of several communities that were destroyed in 1948.
Right.
And in fact, the day before the State of Israel was declared in May 1948 was the day that the Gush Etzion fell. Mm-hmm. And so Gush Etzion, it was kind of on the ashes of the Gush Etzion that the State of Israel was declared. And as a result, Gush Etzion has always occupied a different type of space in Israeli collective consciousness. As a result, I think that when it comes to Gush Etzion, it doesn't have the same sort of connotations, at least to Israelis. I think that for most people around the world, the West Bank is one kind of large undifferentiated mass of where no Israelis were until 1967. The truth is that it is a differentiated mass, and there are, even within Israeli consciousness, there are divisions and distinctions between different areas within Yehuda v'Shomron. Whether those distinctions are based on security considerations, based on proximity to what's called the Green Line, whether it's based on proximity to Arab villages, there are distinctions to be made.
Right. That's why I ask about Har Etzion, the yeshiva, when it's introduced to these new students in the late 1960s, and the and part of the obligation is to do security work in the area, and there's a lot of Arab neighbors, and how sensitive an area it just was, and then on the positive side, what it means that this area was taken over. Or taken back, I should say, in 1967. With all that, I wonder if that would affect the mentality of the first class that comes to study at the yeshiva.
It's quite possible.
Right.
I honestly don't know. I haven't thought about it. But one thing I can tell you, it definitely was played a major role in those early years of the yeshiva. Was the personalities? Starting with it starts with Rav Amital,
right.
But Rav Amital managed to attract some incredibly talented and incredibly incredibly creative people around him. Obviously, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein should have a refuah shlema, or he has. He was back in yeshiva today for the first time in about a month since
wow.
Thank God he's recovering.
Baruch Hashem.
What
year did he come to the yeshiva?
He came to the yeshiva in the early 1970s, 1970, 71, 72.
Rav Amital, I mean, that's just a few short years after the yeshiva started, and Rav Amital viewed it as a partnership. How did he view it, the leadership of the yeshiva, once Rabbi Lichtenstein showed up?
So this is really one of the great things about the yeshiva. The way that Rav Lichtenstein puts it, Rav Amital handed him the keys to the yeshiva and said, here, they're yours. And then Rav Lichtenstein turned around and handed them back and said, no, we're in this together.
Wow.
I mean, you look around at, in the Jewish world, there are yeshivas where there are wars of succession over who's going to be the next, about who's going to be the next Rosh Yeshiva, and students choosing sides. I'm with this Rosh Yeshiva, I'm with that Rosh Yeshiva, and you contrast that to what's happened to Yeshivat Har Etzion, where you really have this model of we call Sheves Achim Gam Yocha, that you have two Rosh Yeshiva who they disagreed. There's no question that they disagreed about a lot of things, and you know they would be the first to tell you that they didn't agree, that they didn't agree on anything. But it was pure power sharing, and it only worked because you had two personalities that were so selfless and so you know, and so uninterested in their own honor.
And does that trickle down? Is that one of the reasons that I read in the book that so many Torah scholars were able to take some type of leadership role very comfortably in the yeshiva?
I think that it definitely did trickle down. I don't know how much of that can be learned. I think that that kind of personality, that kind of humility is really rare. So obviously having a role model like a Rav Lichtenstein and like a Rav Amital can help cultivate that. But, you know, at the end of the day, people are people. If I was in a situation where I was, somebody handed me the keys to a yeshiva and said, you know, here, go ahead, create it in your image. I doubt I'd be able to resist that temptation.
A very good point you're making. Rabbi Eli Fisher is with us live via telephone. By Faith Alone, the story of Rabbi Yehuda Amital is a Magid Books release. Of course, that's an imprint of our friends at Koren Publications. You're listening to Buy the Book here at the Nachum Segal Network as we explore yet another amazing work. Rabbi Fisher responsible for translating this book. It was originally done in Hebrew in honor of the 80th birthday of Rabbi Amital. You could probably write a book just on what we started discussing, the relationship between Rabbi Amital and Rav Lichtenstein, right? I guess that in itself could be an entire work.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's a book that should be written someday because it's unprecedented. It's really unprecedented. I mean, from the times of the Gemara, the Gemara in Brachos talks about wars of succession and animosity
right.
between, you know, various factions in the yeshiva and who the Rosh Yeshiva was and all sorts of, you know, struggles for honor and for respect amongst the rank and file, and here you have the diametric opposite of that. You know, where you have two Rosh Yeshiva that every single shred of respect that they have is 100% completely earned.
Right. Rav Amital was sought after to found this yeshiva by who? Who was after him to take this position and to lead the first year at Har Etzion?
I believe, and this is in the book, and I can't do the pin test on the book, but I believe it was the fellow named Moshe Moshkovich.
And why? What was it about Rav Amital that he felt he would be the right man?
He thought that it seems that he felt that he had the right blend of what I would call soft charisma.
Right.
Where on one hand you don't want somebody that's dry and bland and you know and boring and uninteresting. On the other hand, and I think that we see this in the Jewish world today, excessive charisma can be a very dangerous thing. Right. Soft charisma is on one hand it's charisma in the sense that, you know, the figure, the person is making the material, is making the content attractive, but it's not excessive in the sense that the person never goes beyond the material, meaning it's never about the person, it's always about the content. So I think that's true of Rav Amital. It was never about, he often would say, I'm not interested in making little Amitals. He was not interested in chassidim. He was not interested in people following what he, you know, his every dictate. What he was interested in was teaching, was developing independent minds, bringing people to the place where they can, where they could stand on their own two feet.
Right.
And And sure, he was a very magnetic personality, and he would love singing, and he would love, fearing Tish. But at the same time, it was never, he never let his own personality cloud the content, right, or block the content of what he was actually trying to teach.
And you and Alyosha Reichner paint a picture of a mild-mannered person who generally, including what you just said, that sometimes, fear Tish, etc., but generally did not like the limelight, or I maybe not like is the wrong word, but did not, run after the limelight. And then we see that he takes such a major role in Israeli society by joining the world of politics. How does one reconcile those two things?
He founded the Meimad Party, which was today it would be considered centrist, and I think it would always have been considered centrist. It was a religious party that was willing, that expressed willingness for territorial compromise, which was for Rav Amital felt that he was going back to a different day of religious Zionism. He felt that there was a more moderate voice within religious Zionism that throughout the 1970s and 80s was becoming more and more marginalized as the dominant voice became the voice of Gush Emunim and the voice of the students of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. And he felt it was very important to have another voice, a voice to counter that.
It must have been very interesting because in your book, it's clear that he had quite a relationship with founders of Gush Emunim. And a lot of his, longtime friendships, it seems, or certainly, associations were people from Gush Emunim background. It must have been very interesting to see him be so outspoken on territorial compromise and with a Meimad type party. And I would assume maintain those relationships. Were there a lot of schisms? Was there a lot of resentment from people that he had, forged relationships with, decades earlier when he went ahead and pursued this path in politics?
So first of all, the two figures within Gush Emunim that he was closest with, and these are two figures whose stories are told in Yossi Klein Halevi's new book, Like Dreamers. The two figures are Hanan Porat and Rav Hanan Porat and Rav Yoel Bin Nun.
Right.
Who were both right there at the beginning and who were both also right there at the beginning of the yeshiva. They were both students at Yeshiva Har Etzion. They were older students, meaning they had already finished their army service, but the yeshiva recruited a couple of older guys, to kind of like be a presence in the Beit Midrash in those first years. And Hanan Porat and Yoel Bin Nun were two of those older guys, and they both in one way or another stayed within the yeshiva's orbit, in the case of Rav Porat until he died,
right.
And in the case of Rav Bin Nun, Yibadol L'Chaim, he continues to have a relationship with Yeshivat Har Etzion and with the affiliated institutions. Rav Bin Nun himself evolved. Rav Bin Nun himself is much more of what you would call a dove than he was in his early Gush Emunim years. And like Rav Amital, he evolved. Rav Amital in the early 1970s was playing a very different tune. And for Rav Amital, the change was gradual. I think that according to the book, the major event that really, kind of started the process of him rethinking his relationship to the land of Israel and the state of Israel was the Yom Kippur War when he lost a number of students, eight students he lost in that war. And then in 1982, he was one of the few religious Zionist figures who was protesting the invasion in Lebanon. And while there were certain rabbis who were talking about building settlements in southern Lebanon, in what they called the territory of Asher and Naphtali. Rav Amital was expressing horror at the kinds of things that were going on, especially, you know, particularly after after Sabra and Shatila.
Right.
He was, you know, that was really, I think Sabra and Shatila was the event which caused his, you know, where he realized that the rift between him and, you know, some of the other rabbinic leaders within religious Zionism is simply unbridgeable. Where, you know, where some are talking about settling Asher and the tribe, you know, the territory of the tribes of Asher and Naphtali, Rav Amital is speaking out against the excesses of the Israeli army in Lebanon, or the acts of omission, not the acts of commission.
Right.
He saw that as, you know, that was really when Maimad was born.
You told us how Rav Ben Nun reacted to all this and how he changed over the years. You didn't tell us about Hanan Porat. What was his reaction?
Hanan Porat, you know, he remained part of that the Gush Emunim world until in for the rest of his life. But there's a story in the book where Rav Amital, it was in the early 1980s. I can't remember which issue it was. It was either Sabra and Shatila, it was either the war in Lebanon, or it was the evacuation of Yamit, or it was the peace, or you know, in the broader context of the peace deal with Egypt, where Rav Amital made his views known. Hanan Porat, who at that point was a political activist, he spent several terms in the Knesset,
right.
Disagreed, and Rav Amital actually invited Hanan Porat to address the yeshiva. Rav Amital addressed the yeshiva, you know, with his views, and then he invited Hanan Porat to make his case, to present his case in the yeshiva in front of all the students. So that, you know, it was clear that was, you know, he never expected his students to fall into line, you know, just based on, you know, because you know, based on what his political views were. It was a very touching, a more touching example of that. After the Oslo Accords in the early 1990s, one of the provisions of the Oslo Accords was that the Palestinian Authority was gonna create a police force,
right?
And the police force was going to be armed. They were given machine guns. And it was at that moment, it was that particular provision of the Oslo Accords that Rav Yaakov Maidan, who is now the Rosh Yeshiva in the Gush and Yeshivat Har Etzion, he, as a result of that, he went on a hunger strike. He pitched a tent in the middle of Jerusalem, and he went on a hunger strike to protest giving weapons to the Palestinian police force. And Rav Amital at that point was a minister in the government. He was part of the, you know, after the Rabin assassination, Rav Amital was made minister without portfolio, and he joined the Peres government. And Rav Amital was actually, you know, he supported the government that reached the Oslo Accords. It was known that he was in favor of the Oslo, that he was in favor of the Oslo Accords, but he went and he visited Rav Maidan in his protest tent, and he encouraged him, and he said that, you know, he never expected that his students, and with Rav Maidan, you're really talking about one of his closest students, one of his disciples. He said he never expected his students to fall into line with him politically. He expected them to, you know, to use their own minds, to reach their own conclusions, and to do what they felt was the true and correct and moral thing to do.
But what's amazing is that in so many of these cases, you would think that someone like Rav Maidan, someone from his perspective, would want nothing to do with his, you know, former Rosh Yeshiva or his one-time Rosh Yeshiva. In this type of situation, it is pretty remarkable, knowing human nature, they were able to maintain a relationship.
It is remarkable.
And on top of that, how many seats at the height of the Meimad party did Rav Avital's party hold in the Knesset?
Height? I think the height was 2.
That would be the most.
Yeah.
And as
Rav Avital himself was never a member of the Knesset.
He was just a minister without portfolio.
He was made minister without portfolio as the after the assassination because he was seen as he felt it was important to be a bridge figure. The anti-religious sentiment was at an all-time high after the assassination,
right.
And he felt it was important to he and Peres both felt it was important to have a rabbinic figure within the government. To show that, we aren't heading down the path of civil war.
Right. Yeshivat Har Etzion is known for its scholarship. And I don't mean to demean any other yeshiva in Israel. We can sit here and list hundreds of yeshivot in Israel that are known for their scholarship. But there's something unique about Har Etzion. And I think there's something unique when someone knows that, that a colleague or an associate or someone they know went to Gush. I think they expect something specifically from that type of student. Then maybe that story you told with Hanan Porat has something to do with that. When you're ready and open and willing to let somebody who disagrees with you come in and, propose another point of view, maybe that's part of the importance of Torah scholarship, to be able to take in all the points of view and have your knowledge filled with as many vast opinions as possible.
Yeah, and again, I think that starts, first of all, with Rav Lichtenstein and with Rav Amital.
Right.
Rav Amital's entire worldview was essentially, we have nothing to be afraid of. Yeshivat Har Etzion was one of the first, might even be the first, modern yeshiva, contemporary yeshiva to study Tanakh as a core part of the yeshiva curriculum.
And now, through
the back door, not through something that, I went to other yeshivas. Tanakh is just not on the radar.
Right. And they became the leaders in the academics of Tanakh.
They became the leaders here's the thing. I wouldn't call it academic Tanakh because academic Tanakh becomes, takes on so many assumptions that, I would formulate it as this. It still is the religious study of Tanakh, right? It's studying Tanakh as a form of Talmud Torah, as a form of Torah study, and it is availing itself of a very vast array of modern and classical tools, study tools, especially tools from the world of literature.
Right.
There's an entire toolbox. And if you're curious, I have an article coming out hopefully this summer. It'll be in the Jewish Review of Books on, kind of a review of the Gush School of Tanakh study, what Shalom Carmi calls the literary theological school of Tanakh study and its origins and how the various personalities, which includes Rav Amital and Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Maidan and Rav Yoel Ben Nun,
right.
They're all part of that story. They're all part of that interesting cluster of personalities that wound up on that particular hilltop in those particular years in the early 1970s that really created a revolution in Tanakh study.
Yeah, the tree of Gush Etzion has basically become a Tanakh tree where you could find Talmidim of those who you mentioned also already becoming very high up in that arena.
Yeah, I think that's probably what it's best known for. But I would contend that there are no slouches when it comes to other areas of
understood
of learning either.
Understood. But I think every interview, and there've been many that we've done over the last few months in this segment regarding Tanakh, I think every one of them has had a Gush Yeshivat Har Etzion connection, if not directly, somebody who's actually teaching there right now.
Well, I think that might be because Koren has kind of taken it upon themselves to be the purveyor of this type of Tanakh literature. I mean, a lot of they're publishing, they've published several volumes on the Torah, on Chumash, and they're coming out, with book after book, companion volumes to the, to all of the Sifrei Tanakh.
Right.
And they're not slowing down.
And if you're going to do that, you're going to be associated with a lot of people from Har Etzion. Simple as that. Either who were there.
That's where it's that's where it's coming from. That's who's producing it.
Right. Either who were there or are there now. Speaking to Rabbi Elie Fisher, he translated By Faith Alone is the name of the book, the story of Rabbi Yehuda Amital. It's a Magid Books release, part of Koren Publications. You can go to korenpub.com, korenpub.com. We have another few minutes to go with Rabbi Elie Fisher as we discuss this work and the life of Rabbi Amital, one of Israel's most influential rabbis and teachers. He is responsible for building seminal institutions, including the Joint Army Yeshiva Hesder Program, the Har Etzion Yeshiva, and the Meimad Political Movement. A fascinating figure. If you're not at all familiar with Rav Amital, or if you are somewhat familiar, I highly recommend this book. It is really remarkable. By the way, speaking of the book, and I said earlier I wanted to talk about translating, how difficult it must be to translate a work. I mean, this book, as a book, and I guess you should accept it as a compliment, is really, really well written. And the reason I say it like that is because if one would translate something verbatim or close to it, or or be really afraid about losing certain nuances in the translation, it could be a really tedious translation. Don't you agree? It seems this one, as much as it is a translated work, it is written as if it's a book from scratch. Am I making a correct observation?
I put it this way. I would say that's the greatest compliment that can be paid to a translator, is that I read the book. It doesn't seem like it's translated.
Right. Exactly.
At this point in my career, I switched careers. I was not a translator. I was not trained to be a translator. I never took any formal course in translation. I became a writer as a hobby, meaning while I was a rabbi on a campus at the University of Maryland, and I needed an outlet, and so I started a blog, and I kind of, over a few years, I became a better writer, and then after we made Aliyah, I started translating a little bit as a side thing because I knew that I could write well enough. I mean, I saw some other people's translations, and I was like, man, I can do that. and over time, I kind of developed the skill. I wouldn't even call it a skill, developed the art.
Is there a translator's license? Like I just mentioned how, it seems that you paid careful attention that we wouldn't lose much in terms of nuances that some people fear losing in translation. Yet at the same time, it sounds like an original work. So what type of translator's license is there?
There is no translator's license, at least not officially. There are various translators' guilds. There are various. There's not even an international standard for translation.
But I didn't mean license like that. I meant it in the vein of poetic license. In other words, as a translator.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Do you have a certain leeway that you could describe to us that allows you to get into the area that I described, meaning that nice
yes.
balance of not losing stuff in translation while at the same time it's seeming like an original work?
Yes, there's always translator's license. Translators take a lot of license. You can't translate everything. It's not possible to translate everything. There are so many shades and so many small connotations and alliterations and rhymes and associations that you have in the in the source language that you're just not going to have in the target language, in the new language.
Right.
And every translator has to decide what's going to translate, what they're going to translate and what not. A classic example. Right, the Torah talks about Kanfei Nesharim, and that's translated in the King James Bible as eagle's wings.
Right.
The Nesher technically is the griffin vulture.
Something I never knew.
Right. Technically speaking, a Nesher is a griffin vulture, but there's something that's a little bit less majestic about vulture's wings than eagle's wings.
And therefore,
that's a perfect example of translator's license, right? I don't know whether King James or his, you know, or King James writers had, you know, knew that the Nesher is the griffin vulture. But it was the right choice, because if you're trying to give a sense of majesty, of a magisterial bird, right? You want to be flying on eagle's wings. You don't want to be flying on vulture's wings. Even though the Nesher, the griffin vulture, is quite a majestic bird. They nest up in the Golan Heights, and it's really, really beautiful. But in English, the word vulture has negative connotations, right? It feeds off of carrion. It's a scavenger, and that's just not the kind of connotation that you want to have. Eagle has a connotation of being majestic and regal. So when you talk about Kanfei Nesharim, the correct translation, even though it's a technically inaccurate translation, is eagles. And I say inaccurate because Nesher, on a one-to-one correspondence, Nesher is not eagle. But it's the correct translation, it's the best translation, because that's what captures the most of the original.
Oh.
And that's what the translator is going for. You're not just going for the one-to-one correspondence that this word means this word and this word means this word. You're trying to recreate the feeling that somebody gets. You're trying to recreate the image that somebody gets when they read the original. And obviously, it's impossible to do that completely. But the task of the translator is to do it as well as possible, and that's what makes a translator a good translator.
Does the translator have to do any research? Obviously, the author of a book, their entire project is research.
Absolutely. So absolutely.
It's not just going and translating the words. You actually have to go and research certain things.
Yeah, some of the research that I did while translating the Rav Amital book has led me to a research project that I'm doing right now. Rav Amital, as you know, it says in the Hebrew book, that Rav Amital was born in Hungary.
Right.
He was born in the early 1920s in the city of Grossvardein, Hungary. Well, it turns out that Grossvardein in the early 1920s wasn't in Hungary. It was in Romania.
Right.
And it changed hands several more times before Rav Amital was done being a teenager, right? It had gone from Hungary to Romania after World War I. It went back to Hungary in the Treaty of Vienna in the early 1940s during World War II. And then it went back to Romania after the war. Today it's back to Romania.
Every single
city in the entire region over there has at least three names, right? Grossvardein is the German name.
Right.
Oradea Mare, that would be the Romanian name. And Nagyvarad, that's the Hungarian name.
I was always under the impression that anybody from Romania always said they were from Hungary.
Well, it depends where. But that's part of it, right? I have a PowerPoint presentation on, when we talk about Jewish geography, this is literal Jewish geography, right?
Very good.
The Jewish map looks different because, you know, Vilnius is the capital of contemporary Lithuania, but
right.
Vilnius isn't Vilna, right? When you say the word Vilna, it has different connotations
right.
than when you would say Vilnius. And in Jewish parlance, if you're going to talk about a city and you're going to, you know, and if you're going to talk about Bratislava, right, you're not going to get the same effect. It doesn't have the same resonances as if you would be talking about Pressburg, and it's the same city.
So now you'll be doing a Jewish geography project, or you are doing it already.
So I'm actually doing some of my own family research, and as you mentioned earlier, I'm actually going to be in that part of the world for Pesach as a scholar in residence on a river cruise on the Danube, where we're going to be in Austria and Hungary and Slovakia. And that's, you know, one of the things I'm going to be talking about is that kind of Jewish geography. But and then as a translator, I have to figure out how to deploy that information without it becoming too cumbersome.
Right.
Right? Meaning the first time I mentioned the city, it's like, Rava Mittal was born in Grossverdein, Hungary. Footnote one. Actually, it wasn't this, and it was that, and it went from here to there, and it was Hungary, then it was Romania, then it was Hungary, then it was Romania, and here are the four different names. It becomes cumbersome. That's not what people are interested in reading. They want to read a story.
Right.
Right? So I think in the first instance, I called it Grossverdein, Transylvania, and in parentheses, today, Oradea Mare, Romania. And then several other times, like whenever we mention the name of the city, I'll throw in another tidbit here, another tidbit there. So I want to take the information that I've accumulated through research and deploy it unobtrusively throughout the book so that people get, you know, people get the information, people understand what's, you know, what area of the world we're talking about and when, and, you know, and the fact that it went from one sovereignty to another,
tangential,
you know, without it being too cumbersome.
Tangential references.
That's sort of, you know, I call it, I don't know if this is a technical term or not, I call it either delayed exposition or deployed exposition, right? That the expository information that you're offering, you don't give it all at once. You kind of just like drop it a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there. And I mean, listen, writers do that all the time. That's what writers do. You don't want to give all the expository information right away. You want to keep it interesting enough to keep going, but you also want to round out the picture.
By faith alone, the story of Rabbi Yehuda Amital. It's translated Rabbi Eli Fisher. The book originally written by El Yashiv Reichner. It's a Magid Books release. Koren Publications, KORENPub.com, KORENPub.com. Highly recommended. The book gives a tremendous overview of Rabbi Tal's life, everything that we've discussed today, and so much more. Anybody interested in what's happening in Israel today, you'll get a tremendous perspective by looking at the life of Rav Amital. And that's a point we really should wrap up with, Rabbi Fisher, and that is that Israel today in 2014, so much of it, if somebody is curious why certain things are the way they are, they'll find out if they read Rav Amital's biography.
Yeah, context.
No question about it. This has been a really enjoyable session for me. I thank you so much for joining me and taking the time. And a big yasher koach and Mazal Tov on the release of the book. It is really something. I'm enjoying it tremendously, and I think a lot of people are going to find it fantastic. So thank you so much for joining us and for being here today.
Thank you, Nahum.
Rabbi Eli Fisher, he translated the book. It's called By Faith Alone, The Story of Rabbi Yehuda Amital, Magid Books Release, Koren Publications, KORENPub.com, KORENPub.com. We highly recommend it to everybody. It is really quite a work. And everybody out there should take advantage and check out By Faith Alone, prominently displayed in the Koren Publications website, a Magid Books release. Is your child struggling with Gemara classes? The Koren Talmud Bavli is designed to guide all students through the Daf Gemara. The Koren Talmud Bavli features color illustrations, side-by-side translation, and explanations by Rabbi Steinsaltz, bringing the pages of the Talmud to life for students of all ages and backgrounds. It's available online and at Jewish bookstores everywhere. Again, the Koren Talmud Bavli, it is really amazing. The color illustrations, all the translation and explanations make it a much easier study experience. We highly recommend it, and I hope that our listeners take advantage of the Koren Publications Talmud Bavli and the specials that they continue to offer when it comes to the Talmud Bavli. You've been listening to Buy the Book here at the Nachum Segal Network in its original form on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the stream and repeated a couple of times during the week on the Nachum Segal Network at jmnam.org and nachumsegal.com. I encourage you to please let your friends and everybody you speak to know about this hour each and every week. It's always an amazing hour with some great author and usually some great brand new book to explore. Buy the Book, a presentation of the Nachum Segal Network. Thank you.